The Guardian.
Boris Johnson announces new COVID restrictions just 3 weeks after telling us to get back to the office. I'm Heather Stewart, political editor of The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
This is a great and freedom-loving country, and while the vast majority have complied with the rules, there have been too many breaches, too many opportunities for our invisible enemy to slip through undetected.
We were told to eat out to help out, that it was our patriotic duty to head to our local pub, and that we should send our children back to school, which, as you may be able to hear in my voice, for us meant they brought a nasty cold back home. But now we're seeing the fallout from such advice, as the Prime Minister announced on Tuesday a series of new restrictions to try and stop the spread of coronavirus, with the number of cases rising sharply across the country. From Thursday, 10 p.m. curfews will be imposed on pubs across England. There's now a ban on indoor team sports, and plans for a partial return of sports fans to stadiums from October the 1st have been paused. Wedding celebrations will be limited to just 15 guests. Oh, and we're now being asked to work from home if we can. So did the government prematurely choose to protect the UK economy over public health? And have they ultimately ended up damaging both by trying to save summer, as they called it back in June?
There should be nothing inevitable about a second lockdown.
Despite offering support to these latest restrictions, the government's COVID response was attacked by Keir Starmer as he gave his keynote speech at Labour's virtual party conference, Connected, standing in front of literally a red wall in Darlington. Later on, I ask a former Labour MP and a former Corbyn adviser for their thoughts on the direction Labour's taking under its new leadership. Plus, The Guardian Scotland correspondent Libby Brooks examines the impact the pandemic has had on Scottish voters' feelings towards independence. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, as the Prime Minister announced the latest restrictions, people are wondering whether similar measures that have been in place for weeks in other parts of the country have proven successful in curbing the spread of the pandemic. To look at this and what exactly we're in for over the next 6 months, I'm joined by The Guardian's North of England correspondent, Josh Halliday. Josh, lovely to have you on. Now, Boris Johnson announced stricter COVID restrictions, which will come into effect in England this week. He told MPs in Parliament and then he addressed the nation on Tuesday evening in one of those televised broadcasts. Do you think people are tuning in to watch as fervently as they did back in the spring?
I think it's very doubtful, to be honest, because of the time that it was on, 8 o'clock. Most people are settling down in front of the telly to watch Bake Off, like myself, sadly. And the people that really the message was directed at is people in their 20s and 30s, where he was saying, if you don't stop breaking the rules, you significant minority of them, we're heading for a deep, dark winter and you're going to kill lots of old people. And it's those people that are the most unlikely to be tuned into those three main television channels at this time.
Yeah, and it's worth noting, isn't it, that quite a lot of the country, you've been doing the maths on this throughout, I know, but quite a lot of the country has been under various kinds of rules for weeks now, haven't they? Can you give us some examples of what the rules are around where you are?
Where I am, in Bury, in Greater Manchester, it's about 20 minutes north of Manchester city centre. We're not allowed to have people around to our house or our gardens, and we're not allowed to go visit other people in their house or gardens. But 10 minutes down the road from me, in Bolton, it's much stricter. So households aren't allowed to socialise at all in households, gardens, or restaurants or bars. And these measures came in 2 weeks ago, it was, when basically Bolton had the highest infection rate in the country, which it still has.
And now you've got these nationwide rules that will be sort of layered on top of that, presumably.
That's right. And the national rules actually only go slightly further than what we've had in some parts of the north. It's worth saying that since last week, most of the northeast has been covered by this 10 p.m. curfew that was the headline announcement from Boris Johnson this week, in the sense that these national restrictions won't change life too much for them because they're not an imposition on households mixing at the minute.
And is there any evidence to suggest it's actually been working, Josh, if it's been in place in some places, as you say, for quite a while, since the end of July? Is it helping to bring those infection rates down?
They've not worked hardly anywhere. So in Greater Manchester, the infection rate has more than doubled in all but one of the 10 boroughs that make up that area of 2.8 million people. And in Bolton, which has got the highest infection rate of the country, its infection rate has increased tenfold in the past 5 weeks, and that's despite the restrictions that have been in place since the 31st of July, and despite the extra restrictions that have been in place for 2 weeks. It's the failure, really, of test and trace, where the contact tracers have not been picking up on about half of the people that they should have been contacting, which means that local directors of public health don't know where the disease is spreading or who's getting it. And secondly, what's been the reduction in testing capacity, which has meant that tests have been taken away from areas which have got the highest infection rates in the country, which again means that experts on the ground don't know where the disease is spreading or whether the restrictions that are in place have in fact had any impact.
Which is pretty different, isn't it? I can remember being on a briefing with Dido Harding, the boss of Test and Trace, earlier in the year when the system was launched. And the impression you got then was of something quite forensic, like they would be tracing the source of an outbreak to a factory or a school or whatever, and they would be closing it down, and they would be, you know, they'd be able to contain an outbreak very directly. And obviously that has happened in some places, hasn't it, in sort of food processing plants and whatever. But in most cases, it seems to be well beyond that by the time it's even found, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the fact is that Test and Trace has been quite successful in containing outbreaks where they've occurred in workplaces like some factories. You saw Leicester in June with the outbreak at the clothing factories. And the infection rate was brought down in those areas. In some parts of the north, whole food factories have been closed down for a week or two to get the infection rates under control. But as the summer has gone on, what's happened is that the transmission is starting to happen more frequently in people's households. So about 80% now of COVID transmission happens within your own house. So people who live under your roof and visitors to your house. And that's where Test and Trace has been a lot less successful in bringing the virus under control.
And yet Josh Boris Johnson told Barnsley MP Steph Peacock yesterday that Test and Trace had nothing to do with the spread of the virus.
And I think the continual attacks on local Test and Trace and what the NHS Test and Trace have done are undermining and unnecessary. And
actually, has he got a leg to stand on there?
I don't think so. I mean, it's only 3-4 months since the government was saying that Test and Trace is absolutely central to its strategy of bringing the virus under control. We're in the position we are today where the government still don't have a functioning app yet. And secondly, the rates of people that are being contacted by the system aren't improving. Thirdly, the turnaround time for tests is actually getting worse.
What we are going to get, Josh, tomorrow, drum roll please, is Matt Hancock's app, isn't it, finally? Is that going to help? Is that going to make much difference? You'd have thought when he launched it, it was going to contain the disease on its own. Will it help a bit?
Well, he loves an app, doesn't he, Matt Hancock? You know, he had his own app where I think it ran into difficulties because it popped up with messages such as Matt Hancock wants to access your photos. Funnily enough, that never really took off. But yeah, we've got the app finally coming this week, which is an important moment. In other parts of the UK, they do have their own apps. There is said to be a contact tracing element to this app, but they haven't really said how it's going to work. Apparently, there's a QR code element where you can check into bars and restaurants. But as we know, bars and restaurants are in a really tricky position at the minute, and who knows how long they'll be allowed to be open for. So you could find yourself in a position where in a couple of weeks, we don't really need this app because we're all under quite a strict lockdown.
Well, that's depressing. And these new rules, Josh, that were announced this week could be in place for up to 6 months, couldn't they? There's a massive business impact of that, isn't there? I mean, as you say, you know, businesses in a big part of the north were already struggling under some of these restrictions, whether it's curfews or whatever else. It's going to be huge pressure for some kind of bailout, isn't there?
It really does signify the lack of a joined approach that has been endemic in the government's approach from, you know, for the past few months, is that we announce that these big policy changes are coming down the tracks, but there's no financial support alongside it or no understanding or sort of empathy about how they will affect people and businesses and livelihoods and how they're going to try and protect people's lives. Because you know, I think a lot of people will be waking up today who were planning perhaps to go back into work over the next few weeks, as the government had told us to do. People will be wondering quite simply how they're going to afford to keep the heating on over winter. You know, that's just one aspect of the huge consequences of the announcement by Boris Johnson on Tuesday, which we haven't had an answer to yet.
Yeah, I suspect we may see more on that in coming days. I think Dominic Raab's been hinting today that we might see some targeted measures or maybe some kind of furlough scheme that affects particular sectors. Because as you say, there are businesses that are going to be hit really hard by these measures. Interestingly, Josh, the devolved nations seem to have stuck a little bit more closely to England than we've seen in previous announcements. But Nicola Sturgeon has gone further, hasn't she, and banned household visits. And that'll give us an interesting test case, won't it, of whether going further and cutting the links between households, you know, more than Boris Johnson was willing to do, is actually worked better in controlling the virus.
Yeah, that's right. I think the data will start to show in a couple of weeks whether Nicola Sturgeon's approach has worked compared to England's. I think most people were expecting some kind of ban in England on household gatherings, because that feels like more of a lockdown. And I think when it feels like more of a uniform lockdown, that's when most people start to comply with the rules as they did back in March, April. A ban on household gathering would have more lived up to expectations that were set by Sir Patrick Vallance and Chris Whitty on Monday when they set out the really scary predictions, really, on forecast about what could happen if we don't take any action. And when it was only followed up in England with a 10 p.m. curfew and telling people not really to go back to work, it didn't quite match what the warnings had been 24 hours previous. So that's another way that people would be confused and think of this as mixed messaging, I think.
And Josh, you've watched this unfold closely throughout. Do you think that's where we'll end up? Do you think, like March, these are sort of interim measures, really, and we'll end up with something tougher in a few weeks or months' time?
If I was a betting man, I would have said a two-week circuit breaker, that they're calling it, during October half term, and it would be pitched as a two-week lockdown to save Christmas. But and I still think we are heading to stricter measures, because I can't in England see the 10 p.m. curfew having much of the impact that is needed when the infection rate is so high across large parts of the country now, and in all parts of the country it's growing.
Yeah, well, I for one can't think of anything better than being shut in the house for a fortnight with my children at half term, she says through gritted teeth. It's a long winter ahead, isn't it, coming up. Thanks ever so much, Josh. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much.
Now, as this week proves once again, Nicola Sturgeon is not afraid to go her own way in trying to combat the virus. But as my colleague, The Guardian Scotland correspondent Libby Brooks, reports here, the difference in how Holyrood has tackled the pandemic in comparison to Westminster has had a surprising knock-on effect on the ever-rumbling question of Scottish independence.
I am determined that Scotland will have the ability to reconsider the question of independence, and to do so before the UK leaves the EU, if that is necessary to protect our country's interests.
If you look at the polling that went on during the first independence referendum campaign, in 2013 it had slumped, support for independence had slumped as low as 1 in 4. It has been a steady rise since then. First of all, of course, driven by that independence campaign itself, culminating in the referendum in September 2014. But then a number of other factors have impacted on it, particularly Brexit. And so that by the end of 2019, we saw sort of yes around 49 and no around 51. And then what has happened since the beginning of 2020 is that has tipped into support for independence being over 50%. And that is the first time in Scottish polling history that yes has been consistently ahead over an extended period of time.
On that, as on everything else, I want to be as open and transparent as possible. My view is that it is now inevitable that we will close schools and nurseries.
Since the pandemic began, that gulf in perception of Nicola Sturgeon versus Westminster politicians has widened considerably. And now there is a really huge difference in public perception of how well the Scottish and the UK government have been handling the pandemic crisis. You've got 70 to 75% who think that Nicola Sturgeon has done exceptionally well. And it's almost sort of exactly the opposite for Boris Johnson.
We've all tried to do our best, but I don't think any of us have got any grounds to crow or to feel satisfied about this. It's not politics, it's not constitutional arguments. Every leader of every country right now has a real duty to remain focused.
And in terms of that rise, I was really keen to find out the people kind of in that wee cohort, those percentages that just sort of tip support over into the plus 50% margin. And there are some people that I spoke to who felt particularly that it was almost like this was a dry run for independence because health policy is devolved. You know, there were so many areas that the Scottish government was working independently from the UK government. They were able to see how an independent Scotland would handle itself in a crisis like this. But I think that there's something a bit more personal going on as well. I spoke to one guy called Henry. He's a teacher based in Fife, and he talked about the way that he was watching Nicola Sturgeon doing her daily briefings, particularly at the height of lockdown. And he said to me, you know, I've never been a supporter of the SNP or a massive advocate for Nicola Sturgeon, but when she appeared at those daily briefings, he said there was a connection, there was an honesty that shone through. And, you know, he said to me, look, I'm not naive. I know how politicians operate. But he really felt that she was showing a sort of a down to earth empathy that he connected with and that he really appreciated. And when I was researching this cohort, these people who have sort of gone from no to yes over the last 6 months or so, that kept coming up. Sturgeon's appearances at the daily briefings and how comforted and connected people felt.
And the right to choose is not just a demand from me as First Minister or from the SNP. It is based on the solemn right of the people of Scotland to decide our own future.
I was speaking to Maggie Lennon, who is a committee member of the group Women for Independence, and she was sort of explaining to me women voted no in 2014 because they felt like they weren't getting enough information. They weren't getting straight answers, particularly to concerns that they had about the economy. And she was really sort of emphasising how significant it was for them, those women, those sort of doubtful women, now to see another woman who's prepared to stand up every day and answer questions about this crisis. Particularly after 2014, there was a lot of discussion about women voters, particularly those kind of over 40, about them being more risk averse. And that was why they had voted no. I mean, it seems that really it's just because they're concerned about more risky things, because women are more affected by austerity, cuts in public services, food inflation and so forth. But it's interesting that obviously now after Brexit and after the pandemic, risk itself means a different thing. You know, people on the unionist side of the argument can't point to the UK's strong economy anymore and say, well, that's what you're leaving behind. So the status quo itself has changed. I think what I was really struck by was conversations I had with people who came from some very strongly unionist backgrounds, but who were now saying to me, that's a combination usually of Brexit and now the pandemic, just made them feel that the union itself was no longer fit for purpose. I think what we can't tell from these polling figures now is how sort of lasting that shift is. But I think it is going to be incredibly interesting to see how those voters feel about independence post-pandemic.
We'll have a link to Libby's report on today's episode description on the Guardian website. But for now, we'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll look at how the Labour Party's virtual conference went. We'll be right back.
I'm Jonathan Friedland, and if you didn't know, I'm an American politics obsessive. Every Friday for the next 3 months, I'll chat with some of The Guardian's best reporters and columnists in the US about a single question prompted by the 2020 campaign as they navigate what is already one of the most bitter, divisive, and important presidential contests in American history.
The current president has cloaked American darkness for much too long.
This election will decide whether we will defend the American way of life or whether we will allow a radical movement to completely dismantle and destroy it.
You can find us in our usual Politics Weekly feed on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. Now, normally at this time of year, as party conference season gets into full swing, me and my team are reporting live from wherever the conferences are taking place, if necessary, fearlessly staying up late in the hotel bar to bring you the news. Up first is the Labour Party. But this year was markedly different. For one thing, the COVID pandemic meant nobody was allowed to attend, leaving me to watch from my laptop as members of the Shadow Cabinet addressed as many of the country that wanted to click on the YouTube link. More importantly, though, this connected virtual Labour conference was Keir Starmer's first as party leader. So how did he do? To discuss this, I'm joined by Anna Turley, the ex-MP for Redcar, one of the famous Red Wall seats lost to the Conservatives in the last election, and James Schneider, former advisor to Jeremy Corbyn, who now works for the left-wing organisation Progressive International. Anna, James, it's lovely to have you. I thought I might start by just asking you each whether you're feeling a little bit nostalgic for actual physical conference season. James, are you wishing you were there, that conference existed this year?
I wish conference did exist, yeah. I mean, I was thinking about it and looking back on the last few years and being, you know, right in the middle of it is actually not that fun. It's really intense and a lot of hard work. But there is something about the spirit of it that it is a bit missing when you're basically on Zoom instead.
I think this would have been about my 16th conference, and you just can't beat catching up with old friends. And it's the conversations and the ideas that you kind of bounce around outside of the fringes as much as anything. But I won't be missing the warm white wine and the kind of, you know, bad canapes and crisps flying. But no, it would have been a lot of fun. Zoom's great, but it's not quite the same.
So no doubt we all watched Keir Starmer give his speech in that empty room in Doncaster in front of the cameras.
It's time to get serious about winning. That means we have to change. And that's what we're doing. This is a party under new leadership.
You know, he was making this appeal directly to ex-Labour voters, have another look at the party. I mean, it seems to me one of the big messages was to underline how different he is from Jeremy Corbyn. James, what do you make of it?
Well, I mean, I felt a bit for him to begin with, just because of the setting. You know, it's his first major speech as party leader, and all the drama is sort of taken out of it. He doesn't get the exciting walk on video, the thousands of cheering delegates. So, you know, that did make it a much more difficult speech for him to deliver. And I think some aspects of it were pretty good. But I'm a little disappointed about it. And if I'm disappointed about anything, is I think he didn't really take the opportunity to advance the national conversation at all. I think, you know, quite a lot of what he said, you could just about imagine Boris Johnson or maybe Rishi Sunak saying. And I think that's because over the last 5 years, Labour has really driven the debate forward in the country on austerity and inequality and climate change. And I would have liked to see Keir show some of this new leadership and break new ground. He had this very nice line about how the next manifesto...
It won't sound like anything you've heard before.
Will be the sound of the future arriving. And I would have liked to have heard some more of that.
Anna, what do you make of that? There was seemed to be almost a deliberate intention not to announce any policy. Is that the right thing to do at this stage, or would you like to have had a bit more sort of content to it, a bit more vision?
No, I think it was absolutely right. We've got at least 3 years till the next election, and it's all very well talking about having this great debate and advancing our arguments, but our argument got absolutely battered in December, and we got the worst election for the Labour Party since the 1930s. So I think Keir was absolutely right to say,
when you lose an election in a democracy, you deserve to. You don't look at the electorate and ask them, what were you thinking? You look at yourself and ask, what were we doing?
Look, we're listening. Things have changed. we know we got it wrong. We know we lost your confidence and something's gone seriously wrong, essentially, in our relationship. We have to repair that damage. And I think he had to exactly have that sort of humility and that sense of listening. But I certainly had a lot of vision and a lot of values about decency, about opportunity, about fairness, compassion, and security, important messages for people from across the political spectrum. And as ever in a conference speech, you're not just talking to your own people, you're talking to the country, you're talking to people here in the Reggae constituency who roundly rejected the Labour Party in December, and we've got a long way to go to win them back.
And patriotism, a sort of tone of patriotism was part of that, James, wasn't it? Starmer's talked a little bit about this. He evidently feels perhaps the party didn't sound patriotic or didn't appeal to sort of that set of values under Corbyn's leadership. Is that right? And is it the right thing to do to sort of stress that? Or does that make you feel a bit uncomfortable?
So I think stressing patriotism is something that pretty much all Labour leaders will do in their speeches. I remember Jeremy's first speech as leader at party conference, which had lines about, I love this country, and it was pre-briefed as showing patriotism. I think there is an element of the way in which Keir's gone about it. There's a little bit of leading with the chin. It's like saying, we weren't patriotic and we're not patriotic, but now we are going to be, rather than building on some of the themes beforehand. The role of Brexit wasn't really ever brought up. And I think if we were trying to say as a party, we want to move on from Brexit, we also want permission to be able to have things to say about it in these next crucial 3 months, I think some big statement to those constituencies that he mentioned and constituencies like Anna represented about how the party got it wrong on Brexit and looking like we were trying to overturn the result of the referendum and how that broke trust.
But he doesn't want to talk about it, does it? That's his main. He almost immediately after the December election, Keir Starmer started to say this debate is over. I mean, I don't know whether you had a kind of wry smile at that, James, because I think probably Jeremy Corbyn spent quite a lot of his leadership trying to say that debate was over and was never really allowed to. But you think it's not the right thing to not talk about it?
No, I think the right approach after the 2016 referendum was to try to move on from Leave and Remain. It was entirely the right thing to do. It was the right thing to do in 2017, and it was the right thing to try to do after 2017. And of course, you know, we all know that Keir helped us to not follow that strategy and to talk more about it and lean more Remain. But nevertheless, Keir is doing the right thing now by not trying to reopen those wounds. But I think that in order to have credibility to move beyond it, we want some permission to be able to challenge the government on things and make political arguments. And I think we won't be able to do that if everything that the party does is seen as basically, oh, look, here it is, the Benn Amendments, the Surrender Act, trying to stop Brexit again in a different form. So I think having gained that permission would have been a good move, but instead it was skated past.
James and I are inevitably going to have different views on this, because for me, the reason why we struggled to talk about Brexit was because people didn't have trust and faith in us as a party. The number one issue for me on the doorsteps, not just in December, but actually also in 2017, throughout that period, was Jeremy Corbyn. People didn't believe us. They didn't think we were on their side. They thought we were extreme. They thought we were too left wing. And these are words that people said to me on the doorsteps. They thought our manifesto was a free for all. And they thought we didn't have a position on Brexit. And, you know, we lost the referendum, in my view, because we didn't have a sufficient argument for communities like mine, who are going to be and will be absolutely hammered by Brexit. Even a soft Brexit, or, you know, if we'd have negotiated Theresa May's deal, areas like mine with chemical industry would be absolutely ravaged. And for me, it was a terrible abdication of our responsibility not to make a proper argument and to take people in communities like ours with us on a journey about Brexit. We simply just, we'd lost their trust. They didn't believe anything we had to say. And you know, that's a tragedy that I believe came from a lack of leadership. So inevitably, James and I will disagree on that. But I want to just make the point about patriotism, because it is really important. And I've heard a real shift in the language, and I'm sure many people around the country have experienced that in the last few years over issues around essentially nationalism, populism. And we've seen the kind of culture wars that Boris Johnson and Tory MPs in areas like this are pushing. And my view that is because, again, we abdicated the space for ordinary, decent, patriotic working class people to feel that Labour was on the side of them, that Labour had their country's best interests at heart, and that Labour would stand up for Britain. And by vacating that space and looking like we were embarrassed to talk about any of these issues or to stand up for Britain in terms of national security and issues like that, we drove people into the arms of a populist right-wing government. And I think that's an absolute tragedy.
What about the way he deals with this government, James? So we've talked a lot on this podcast over recent weeks about this idea of constructive criticism, which Keir Starmer has, the approach that he's taken to the government during the pandemic.
And this is the big difference between the Prime Minister and me. Whilst Boris Johnson was writing flippant columns about bendy bananas, I was defending victims and prosecuting terrorists.
And in his speech, he compared himself to Boris Johnson, didn't he? He sort of said, I was being a lawyer, you know, prosecuting criminals and fighting for people's rights, while Boris was being sacked for making up quotes from and so on. Is that the right thing to do? Should he be making more of these kind of personal attacks?
I don't think it's just enough to say the other lot aren't very competent. You need to have an explanation for why. And I think it's good that Keir's starting to take Boris Johnson on a bit more, but I'd like to see it move off the personal and try to explain why. So try to explain why is it that they're incompetent. It's not just that Boris Johnson's not very good at doing things. It's because he serves a particular set of interests and those interests are not your interests, which it doesn't have to be. We're just opposed to everything for the sake of opposing it. It should be on the basis of politics and showing people that whose side the government is on, which is fundamentally not theirs.
Unfortunately, people price some of that stuff in with the Tories. They expect them. They know who they stand for. They stand for the rich, the wealthy. They don't stand for ordinary people. They price all of that in, the corruption, the scandals. For some reason, you know, people seem to have, well, quite rightly, they have a higher standard for us than they do for them. What always does for the Tories is competence. That's always what is their downfall. And so I think Keir's absolutely right to continue to press on that. And this is incompetence on a scale, you know, that is just breathtaking. We have a national global pandemic and it's clear how badly the government is failing. And Keir is absolutely right to just expose them meticulously, ruthlessly, and with the detail and demonstrate that he's a leader in waiting, that he's credible, that he's effective, and that he's competent. And he's, you know, he's ready to lead a Labour government that will put people's safety and health and well-being first.
And James, moving on just from Starmer, he will want to present his party, won't he, as a kind of a government in waiting, a potential team. And under Jeremy Corbyn, we saw a lot of these very strong figures around him, John McDonnell in particular. We don't yet have a sense so much of this shadow cabinet, do we, and what they stand for and who are the strong figures in it. Has that changed at all while this virtual conference has been going on?
I don't think it has particularly, but I think Angela Rayner in the last 6 months has done quite a lot and, you know, is getting known in the country and is a real asset to the leadership team. I don't think yet either Annalise Dodds or Nick Thomas-Simmons have yet punched through into public consciousness. And it is difficult to do that with an online conference in the middle of the pandemic when you're not announcing anything significant. Well, when you're not announcing anything at all, that does make it quite difficult. So I think there's still work to do on building out that whole team, at least in the public imagination.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, actually. You know, I was getting a bit concerned that Keir's doing a great job turning the tanker around and, you know, drawing level in the polls and so on, outpolling the party. And I really felt he needed his support. I mean, look at great Labour leaders of the past and they've had, you know, great shadow cabinets, your Robin Cooks, your Mo Mollems, your David Blunkett, Gordon Brown, you know, have that strength and depth in number. And Keir really needs that. He's doing great, but he's got to have those others really coming forward. But we've got massive talent. I'm really, really delighted by the front bench. You saw Ed Miliband and Angela Rayner both, you know, lay some good blows on Boris Johnson this week. We've got real talent, people like Bridget Phillipson and others. You know, I think people just need a bit of space. The pandemic obviously has made things very difficult. Parliament hasn't really been as kind of thriving and as active as it might have been. But I think, you know, again, we have time and I'm really looking forward to a really strong, credible team coming forward and expressing themselves, finding their personalities and really, you know, representing all different strands of the Labour Party in real strength and depth.
And hopefully that gives us then a better sense of what Keir Starmer's Labour Party stands for, James. Do you think that's right once you start to see more of a team?
Yeah, maybe. But I think part of the reason why we haven't seen very much from, say, Annalise Dodds or Nick Thomas-Simmons that would get into the public consciousness, I don't think is necessarily their fault. But part of that is the centrally directed diktat to try to not say very much, which has been a hallmark so far of this leadership. I think once Keir sets out a more concrete and fuller vision of the future, the thing that he promised in this speech, then everybody will be able to play their role within that vision and build it out. I think that's what we need. I think we need that bit of leadership from him to show some more concrete direction, more about how we would change the country and change people's lives. And then it would be easier for, and basically give permission for those other members of the shadow cabinet to go out there and do the same.
I think there's plenty of time. The biggest issue, the biggest line in the sand had to be new leadership and a new face at the top of the party. That was what everybody needed to see around this way. And that's been the most important thing to drive through over the last 6 months. And obviously we've had a pandemic where it's been absolutely right that Keir's been at the forefront of that. So I think there's plenty of time for others to come through. There's a huge amount of talent. People will find their voices and, you know, it's very exciting.
And we should say one other way in which Starmer wanted to clearly draw a line under the Jeremy Corbyn regime was he had Ruth Smith, the former Jewish former MP, introduce him, didn't he, and talked about the issue of anti-Semitism, Anna.
But first, I'd like to say a few words about how we got here.
Yes, and that was really great to see. Ruth is not only a friend of mine, but she's just one of the most phenomenal people I've ever met, incredibly strong and brave and true to herself. And what she's had to endure, along with others like Luciana Berger over the last few years, has been absolutely heartbreaking. And, you know, I've seen PLP meeting after PLP meeting where they stood up and begged for help. And none came. And so for me, there couldn't have been a better statement, better symbol of how we're getting to grips and turning the party around and dealing with what was a horrible, toxic poison in our party. So I'm delighted for Ruth. I thought she did a brilliant job. And it's a really bold and positive statement. The party is changing. Never again will we go back to that sort of toxic racism that that unfortunately filtered throughout the party. And I look forward to, it's going to be tough, but I look forward to Keir's response to the HRC report, because I've every confidence now that he's really going to take this to task.
Anna Turley, James Schneider, thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And that's all from us this week. For anyone wanting to learn more about the public health side of a potential second wave, today in Focus we'll be talking to some of The Guardian's top reporters about what to expect over the next few months in Thursday's episode. And if you're looking to catch up on what's happening in the US presidential election, in this week's Politics Weekly Extra, Jonathan Friedland and Daniel Strauss will try and find an answer to the question, why is the Senate race so important in 2020? So make sure to listen to that this Friday. Just look for it in our usual Politics Weekly feed. But for now, I want to thank our guests, Josh Halliday, Libby Brooks, James Schneider and Anna Turley. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Heather Stewart, just off to find another Strepsil. Please look after yourselves and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.